You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, December 23rd, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone. On this date in 1954, the first successful kidney transplant was carried out in Boston, of all places.
In a bathtub full of ice.
That's right.
In Los
Angeles. Your neck of the woods at Peter Bent Hospital, now known as Brigham and Women's Hospital.
So who was it done on, and are they still alive, and what do they like to have for dinner?
The kidney was donated to Richard Herrick by his identical twin, Ronald. Richard lived until 1962, so he got by for 8 years.
Hmm.
How long did Ronald live?
Let's see. The article doesn't say that. I think he was hit by a train.
He died on the table right then. They harvested all of his organs.
Is that what they did?
That's awful.
Oh, no. And for our friends in Mexico, tonight is also the Night of the Radishes.
Cool.
Oh, yes, the Night of the Radishes.
Yes, in which everyone dresses up as a giant radish and terrorizes the local community.
Mexico is awesome.
But back to the identical twin thing. So that's the low hanging fruit, right? I mean, that's the least rejection potential possible, is to get a donation an organ donation from your identical twin.
Right.
No, I think the least, Steve, would be to clone your own tissues and then implant it. That would be the least, wouldn't it?
No, not necessarily. In fact, you probably are more identical to an identical twin than you would be to a clone.
Uh huh.
Really?
Why is that?
Utero and utero. Probably.
Yeah. It's also, it depends on exactly how you. What cloning technique you do, but there might be mitochondrial differences between you and a clone, whereas you got the exact ones from your mother. I mean, the thing is, with an identical twin, it was the same cell to begin with, and then it splits. It's really, everything is identical. And then you share a womb for 9 months. With a clone, there's potential differences in terms of it's really just your nuclear DNA that's being put into some other cell that could have different mitochondria and different cytoplasm, and will get raised in a different womb. I don't know if that would make an actual difference in organ rejection, but it certainly wouldn't be less of a rejection potential than an identical twin.
Hmm. Huh.
I said
happy Night of the Radishes, everyone.
I never read about in detail about this, but I would have completely guessed if you did a science or fiction that the cloning would be 100% your tissue.
I said that's kind of why I said it depends on what method is being used, but it doesn't have to be. It just means that your nuclear DNA is being used to create an embryo.
I'm going to go with the Raelian technique of cloning.
Just faking a press release.
Steve, giving away all the secrets.
So, Steve,
don't give it away.
I was watching a show with a friend not too long ago, and it showed those women that had their necks. They put the rings around their neck, or that big piece of metal. You know, then it said that if they took that thing off of someone that had a very developed case of this, or whatever you would call it, it's not a case, but just an example of it, that they would die because they can't hold their head up and their windpipe would get crushed.
What's amazing is where the segue came from.
Wait, hold on. So then he said to me, "All right, I'm just giving you a little backstory." All right,
I like backstories.
So anyway, so then he said. That he read recently about this woman who had her trachea replaced, or they cloned her trachea passageway,
right?
Or something.
That's correct.
Right.
No, I don't think we did actually.
So they actually did some type of cloning for her that made an organ out of it.
Yeah, that's right. But again, where they're starting with this kind of technology is with organs like a trachea that has a scaffold that has a structure to it, and then they just sort of flesh it out by using
stem cells.
Yeah, so that is correct. That was done recently.
So what does that have to do with the woman with the rings around her neck?
Don't ask why.
I just told you. Because we were watching that show, and then
because
he told
necks
me
were
about
involved.
The transplant, and we started talking about.
I don't know if that's true, by the way, about the rings around the neck. I've always heard that as well, but I've never had the opportunity to verify that.
It was on TV, Steve, so come on.
All right.
Did you know there were radishes?
But it does make sense. If you think about it, I think it makes sense because it's not, first off, it's not elongating your neck when they add the rings. From what I've read, I forget what the source was, but it's not really making your neck longer. It's just kind of like squishing down
your
clavicles
shoulders
and things and kind of just pushing everything down. But the muscles of your neck, I would think, would just get so weak that they wouldn't be able to do anything after a while. So it makes sense. Okay. It's plausible. I'll just say
that's certainly true. Yeah. Even if people, after an accident, if they get collared, you put a cervical collar on for too long, your neck muscles will get weak and atrophy from disuse. So, but that doesn't mean that you die if you take it off.
Right.
Your head may loll over to the side. But more importantly, there are actually some news items that we planned on talking about this evening. That we should probably get to.
I thought we were just going to gab. It's Christmas.
I know, but
I'm
not prepared to talk about all this stuff. Let's
think of the children. Something.
The event consists of exhibition of sculptures of radishes, which can weigh up to 3 kilograms. Did you know that? And they make little themes out of them, including activity scenes.
Do you guys watch Entourage?
Yes, I do. I like that.
It's a really funny show. One of the actors on the show is Jeremy Piven. He plays Ari Gold.
Oh God, he's awesome. He's the show.
He's in that. He's perfect for that role. He's perfect. So I guess between seasons, Jeremy Piven was doing a Broadway play called Speed the Plow, and he had to pull out because he was fatigued and was having some weakness, and he. Or a spokesperson announced that he had to pull out because he has come down with a case of mercury poisoning.
Indeed.
Oh, how the hell did that happen?
It's a pretty unique excuse for rehab.
There's one whole angle of this story is he being truthful? Was he just trying to pull out of the play because he didn't want to do it anymore? Is he hiding some other reason that he had to do it, which I'm personally not interested in at all? That's just Hollywood gossip kind of stuff. Who cares? But the interesting thing about this is the whole question of the plausibility of his claim that he had mercury poisoning. How did it happen? And of course, whenever you even mention the word mercury, it's so politically charged these days because of the claims that mercury's in vaccines and also amalgam fillings, mercury amalgam fillings causing all kinds of things. There's a lot of pseudoscience surrounding mercury. So, of course, the nut jobs come out of the woodwork at the very mention of the word mercury. So here's one of the questions is, if he does have mercury toxicity, where did it come from? He's claiming
sushi and Chinese herbs.
Yes, he's claiming that he's an avid sushi eater twice a day on a regular basis for years.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot.
That's a lot of sushi. And that he also takes some Chinese herbs that may have contributed to the mercury toxicity.
Oh, boy. Here we go.
Mercury plus in a pill.
I don't want to know things about actors that I like.
Well, I mean, this goes without saying that there's going to be a lot of, health nuttery going on with any buff Hollywood actor. I mean, that would just be my base assumption. I'd be surprised if that weren't the case, in fact. So there's been a lot of chatter about, how much fish would you, in fact, have to eat?
Yes.
There's a lot of variables, exactly what kind of fish are you eating, over how long.
Yeah, if you were eating, twice a day those large fish that are supposed to accumulate vast amounts of mercury, I could see it being possible because there are always those mercury warnings, especially in Massachusetts. We get every now and again, you can't eat fish from the lakes and rivers of Massachusetts. Or at least you should keep it to once a week.
Well, how much mercury is too much? I mean, do we have a way of getting rid of mercury that we've eaten?
Yes, there are ways to get rid of mercury. If you have genuine mercury toxicity, you actually can chelate it. Use chelation therapy.
No. But you can't do it naturally, right? Like your body won't do it on its own.
No, you get rid of mercury over time. Yeah, it doesn't stick with you forever.
Oh, okay.
But it builds up quickly, right? It doesn't leave your body.
The methyl mercury can contaminate fish does hang around for a lot longer than say the ethyl mercury that you would find in thimerosal, which is in some vaccines.
Jay, you've never urinated and have it come out silver?
No.
Oh, never mind.
Bobby, you okay?
So here's the thing. The EPA in the United States, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, have their levels of safety for mercury in fish, and they do recommend that you avoid eating a lot of certain kinds of fish you know, they recommend more caution if you are pregnant or for small children. For example, you know, light tunas are better than albacore tunas. Shellfish are better than swordfish. Swordfish and shark are apparently have high levels of mercury in them.
Swordfish.
But critics claim that the EPA and FDA are being overly cautious. That in fact, if you look at islands in the Pacific and Japan, for example, they eat a lot more fish than Americans eat, and they don't get mercury toxicity from it. In fact, there have been a number of interesting studies looking at this very issue. There was one done in the Seychelles Islands, where islanders eat like 12 fish meals per week. So that's the same or more than what Jeremy Piven was eating. And they did indeed exceed the EPA guidelines for mercury levels, but there was no effect on their IQ when they were compared to Americans. Although a separate study that looked at the Faroe Islands, where people ate whale meat, found that there was actually problems with mercury toxicity. So the thinking was that, you know, the whale meat has about 10 times the concentration of mercury as even the worst fish. So that the effect of mercury depends greatly on how much of a dose you get, not just the cumulative amount that you're getting. Also, the reason why this is so hotly debated is because fish are tremendous brain food. I mean, fish contains a lot of substances that are important for brain development, and therefore if you just reduce or eliminate fish from the diet, it actually can cause more harm than good.
Is that the omega-3 advantage, Steve?
It's not just omega-3. It's the sphingolipids, and there's other things in fish that actually that are important for building brain tissue. So fish is actually the best source of quote-unquote brain food. That's actually literally true. So one concern is that by being overly cautious and maybe scaring people away from eating fish, you actually might be causing more harm than good. And that this huge safety buffer that the EPA and FDA have for quote-unquote safe levels of mercury, you know, again, may be too cautious. So that even though if you put in, like if you calculate how much mercury Jeremy Piven may have been getting from the amount of fish he claimed to eat, it is above the safety levels for the EPA and the FDA, but probably still not high enough to cause symptoms and the symptoms that he was complaining of.
So what about the other side of the coin now? What about the Chinese herbs he was taking?
Yeah, so that's a total variable. We had spoken, I think, it was a science or fiction, I think, earlier this year about certain Ayurvedic medicines that were reviewed by the FDA and found to have unsafe levels of heavy metals, including mercury. Now, Piven says he was not taking Ayurvedic medicine, but he was taking Chinese herbs. And again, who knows what they – I have no idea what that means. You know, what specifically they were. Certainly there's the risk that they were contaminated, but that's not known at this point in time. Another wrinkle to this whole thing is that Jeremy Piven's doctor is Carlin Kulker, who is kind of a dubious figure himself. He is not only a physician to a lot of many celebrities, he's also a bodybuilder himself. And he got caught up in some supplement scandals.
The power.
So his history is not pristine either. Some have actually gone as far as, I'm not doing this, but some have gone as far as to accuse him of just basically lying for Jeremy Piven to cover up whatever's really going on. I don't have any information about that. But
my favorite quote is from the writer of the play that he was in, one of my absolute favorites, David Mamet. He said, my understanding is that he's leaving show business to pursue a career as a thermometer.
He's obviously pissed that the guy's back.
In other words,
he
doesn't buy it.
An oral thermometer, I hope.
A little bit, yeah.
All right, so what do you think is going on, Steve?
I don't know. I'm just interested in the mercury question.
He also became friends with someone called Mercury Man, and I think that's a dangerous relationship.
Yeah. The one thing I couldn't find out in all the reading that I did on this topic was how was the diagnosis of mercury toxicity made? Because there is a cottage industry of bogus labs with invalidated or you know basically not legitimate mercury tests, and everyone gets diagnosed with mercury toxicity if you send them samples. It's totally bogus. So if he was using one of these dubious labs, well then it means nothing. You know, then the mercury toxicity itself is bogus. But I could not find out in any of the reporting on this how the diagnosis was made. Was it a legitimate test or one of these bogus tests? You know, it's also possible that Jeremy Piven has something else going on and it's being missed because of the circus around this question of the mercury. That's always my concern. And that's always what I tell patients who get caught up in some hysteria over some possible diagnosis that I think is a distraction and probably not true. That I don't want this to distract us from finding out what the real answer is, because something is going on.
It's probably lupus.
Let's find out what it is. Well, it could be those symptoms are so vague. I mean, it could be anything, any chronic illness.
I'm just kidding. It's never lupus. Everybody knows that.
Does this affect the date of the start of the next season of Entourage? That's all I care about.
I hope not. I love that show. We have a bit of a medical theme this week, actually. There's just been a lot of pseudoscience and medicine in the news recently. So actually, we're going to talk about a few of them, all themed around the question of what's the harm. And that's something that we get asked a lot when we start talking about, you know, unscientific or unconventional medical practices. People say, what's the harm if people want to believe in it? Well, there's actually quite a bit of harm. And in fact, some of our friends have started a website called whatstheharm.net, which is a way to document harmful escapades with unscientific medicine. But there are a few specific cases I want to talk about. The first one is a father who was recently convicted of abuse because he caused his daughter significant brain damage.
Yeah, this is a really depressing story. What happened basically, and a lot of SGU listeners sent this in, so thank you, you guys, especially you Australians are totally on top of this. In Australia, there was a father who force-fed his daughter Manitech dietary supplements instead of giving her adequate medical care for an infected heart problem. So instead of giving her, you know, actual medical treatment, he treated her with these basically nutritional supplements that are produced by a company that's basically a multi-level marketing, aka pyramid scheme, where it's basically just BS claim after BS claim. They're still operating. You can go to their website and read all up on their crazy BS products. In this case, it was particularly sad because the man literally force-fed the girl to the point where the pills were, you know, like causing sores in her mouth, and the doctors had to perform these emergency procedures on her, and she ended up having severe brain damage, and she can't walk anymore. There are a ton of just horrific disabilities that she now has because of this. And the father was finally sentenced, and he got 6 months in prison. 6 months for basically destroying his daughter. And to make it all that much sadder, the father suffers from brain damage himself that he got from a previous injury. So it's all around really sad. The girl is ending up brain damaged and unable to walk. The father only gets 6 months in prison, and Manitech is still in business.
Right. Yeah, it's very sad. I mean, the you do have to wonder how much the father's brain injury mitigated his guilt and this sentence. But that's not really the point. I mean, the point is that, you know, we are now in a culture where there is a tremendous amount of anti-scientific fear-mongering and nonsense in the public domain regarding medicine. And the public is being treated to a lot of, you know, conspiracy theories about not to trust the FDA, don't trust your doctors, you know, these false dichotomies, all of the propaganda that's being used to prop up so-called alternative medicine. And there's a lot of downstream effects of that. It's a lot easier to sell people nonsense when that's infused in the culture like this. And this is, I think, just one manifestation of that.
Yeah, and Manitech, that's basically how they make their business. What they do is, a lot of it is sold word of mouth. And when they do that, it means that the people who are selling it are making all sorts of claims that the company doesn't have to actually have on their website, but the people who are selling them are telling people that they can cure all kinds of diseases like Down syndrome and just random things that, you know, no nutritional supplement is ever going to cure, cancer, things like that. And it results in this company being you know, it's very difficult to prosecute a company like that because you go to their website and they have these, you know, very generic terms about how their pills promote health and they're for your total wellness and they help your cells communicate with each other. And it's all these squishy terms that actually don't mean anything at all and make it very difficult to prosecute them. But even despite that, they've still had they had an $11 million class action lawsuit that they just lost earlier this year. And there was a, you know, there have been a lot of lawsuits against this company. But unfortunately, they still
keep going. Yeah, unfortunately, those kind of judgments, you know, $10, $20 million, it's just a slap on the wrist. It's just the cost of doing business when these companies are making hundreds of millions of dollars. Recently, Airborne, you know, basically vitamin supplement that claims it could, you know, reduce your risk of catching the common cold, had to pay a $7 million, you know, class action lawsuit settlement in California. But again, they're making hundreds of millions of dollars. Who cares if they get a $7 million slap on the wrist? I really think these judgments are off by an order of magnitude.
And if you look at the Airborne example specifically, what they did was, you know, when they first came out, they claimed to, you know, cure the common cold, and then they weren't allowed to say that anymore. And then they had their packaging said that it was proven in clinical trials to help the symptoms of cold. And it turned out that those clinical trials were two guys paid by Airborne in an office somewhere. So they had to take that off the packaging. And they just kept getting more and more generic. And now, if you look at the packaging for Airborne, it's like, take Airborne. Because.
But the thing, here's the thing. The standard used to be that if you create a market for your product with fraud and lies and false advertising, that you're not entitled to benefit from that market that you created through your false advertising. So I think that I don't see that that's happening anymore with these suits. I mean, Airborne should be sued, should have to pay or should be fined every dime they've made off of their product, you know, basically being generated through the market they created with their false advertising. So now they could just sort of sit back. They've already created the market. The notion that it treats colds is already out there. So now they could just be really coy and stay within the letter of the law and make money off of the product, that's the information that's already out there. But that shouldn't be the case.
Right. I was even I was at the pharmacy the other day, and Airborne was displayed on a rack next to the pharmacist with a little sign that said, "Pharmacist recommends." And I said to him, "You don't actually recommend that, do you?" And the pharmacist looked at it and he's like, "I didn't put that stuff there, but I don't know. Why not?" And I'm like, "What do you mean, why not?" "Because it's total BS." And I had to explain to him exactly what it was. He had no idea at all. Yeah. And it was
so depressing. He doesn't care what happens on that side of the counter.
Rebecca, you yelled at a pharmacist? Nope.
Yes. Is that not allowed? I yell at everybody who annoys me.
Wouldn't that pharmacist know that Airborne is BS? I mean, don't those guys have training?
But pharmacologists are actually highly trained. And I know some of them that are livid about the whole blurring of the lines between, you know, pharmacology and, you know, herbalism and alternative medicine. In fact, I had a brief email exchange with a pharmacologist who specializes in natural substances, you know, like plants and whatnot. And it's a subspecialty within pharmacology. And he complained that this whole supplement herbal nonsense is ghettoizing his profession.
Oh, my God.
Word.
Wow. That's the word he used.
And straight up.
So, but I guess that's, there are then on the other end of the spectrum, there are those, that the ones that we call shruggies, who just don't care. It's, again, as Evan said, it's on the other side of the counter. Who cares? Which is a problem. It is sad. And I wish this was the last bad thing we had to talk about tonight on the what's the harm front, but there's actually a few more stories.
Can't we lighten it up? I mean,
we got light at the end. We could just summarize these.
Yeah, and Rebecca, I have awesome quotes for tonight.
We've been emailed on all of these many, many times. We just haven't gotten to them, so they just piled up. So we're just going to get through them all tonight. And this one's from a few weeks ago. This is, I think, also from Australia. This was a healer who got an infection in his foot. And this is a man by the name of Russell Jenkins. And he decided not to treat his foot infection with conventional medicine, he decided to treat it with honey because his homeopath told him that that would be a good idea.
But isn't the guy a healer?
Yeah.
So why didn't he heal himself?
Right, I don't know.
Sweet.
So I guess he tried. Didn't work. The guy let me. The foot basically became gangrenous, and ooh, he died of the subsequent infection. He became septic and died.
Oh no.
Yeah, yeah, maybe he. Maybe he was a healer, but it was H E E L E R.
What's wrong?
But I'm bum.
I mean, can you? Can it be any more ironic or moronic?
Yeah, it's terrible. I mean, and again, he's just so dedicated to his ideology, you know, that he, you know, let it go that far, all the way to the point where he died. And
this is another example that proves that Russell has no friends.
Well, I don't know that that's the case. I mean, his mother expressed incredible, you know, regret that he died in a way that was so wasteful when he could have been saved by, you know, antibiotics. By one call to the doctor. This guy also was a diabetic. Now, they were set up for these kind of infections.
Oh, I mean, God.
So he was in a high-risk group as well.
Yeah, but nobody said, hey, Russ, that thing is stinking up the room.
Like, I don't know that that's the case, Jay. I don't know that that's the case.
Well, I could see Jay's point of view, though. You would think something like that would, you know, you'd think there'd be an intervention, you know? Yeah. People would just.
There probably wasn't anything on the level of an intervention. But remember, if this guy is in this mode himself, then he obviously could be very opinionated about it and not cave to pressure easily.
Yeah, but that guy's leg started smelling like an old hot dog. You know, I mean, at some point, somebody had to be like, "Hey, bro, it's time to go."
The honey's not working. You know, we need to kick it up a notch. Right. Yeah. That's common sense. But you know, when you're ideologically locked in like that, common sense goes out the window. Yeah, obviously these are extreme examples, but this is how bad it can get.
That's a real Darwin Award right there.
It is. That's a real Darwin Award.
That's a good point.
There was a more recent story. This one just from a couple of days ago. The first face transplant in China. A man by the name of Li Gaojing, who again received the first face transplant in China. There have been a couple other face transplants prior to that, one in France, for example. And then the first full face transplant occurred just this year in Cleveland. That was actually just a couple weeks ago. But this gentleman, the Chinese gentleman, decided not to take the immunosuppressant drugs that's required to prevent rejection. And he rejected the transplant and
died.
The
ultimate rejection. Yeah.
He decided to take herbs instead. Yeah. And the herbs didn't quite cut it.
And that was that and article. I had a problem with the first line of that article and the last line. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the stuff in between, too. But the first one is like a Chinese man who received a face transplant in 2006 has died, highlighting the risks of a recent groundbreaking U.S. operation. Well, no, it's not really the risk of the operation. It's the risk of not listening to your doctor.
Yeah.
That's the real risk.
I mean, transplants are serious business. I mean, the biggest issue with transplants, of course, is that your body may reject the foreign tissue as an invading, you know, organism, and your immune system attacks it. So you have to suppress the immune system in a very specific way, and actually to a pretty powerful degree, in order to minimize the chance of rejection. That's hand in glove with a transplant. I mean, you can't give somebody a transplant unless you also have confidence that they are going to be compliant with the treatment regimen afterwards. If somebody said, I'm not going to take the immunosuppressive drugs, or I can't afford them, or in this case, he said he lived too far away from the hospital in some village somewhere, they don't get the transplant. That's it. It's like basically malpractice to give somebody a transplant unless you are very confident that there's a mechanism in place where they will get their immunosuppressive medication.
He should have gotten the transplant from his twin brother.
Duh.
No.
Steve, I have a news story.
Okay.
In Massachusetts last week, a woman noticed an abnormal mole on her skin, and she went to her doctor, and she had it removed. And then she had her baby vaccinated, and everyone lived.
Oh, I hate it when that happens.
That's my news story.
Excellent.
Boring.
And then she felt sick, and she got she went to the doctor again, and she got that Z-Pack thing, and
totally took care of it.
She feels a lot better now. Yeah, she's actually all right. So And then she got a flu shot, too.
Are you saying that real medicine one day will become the abstract as opposed to the norm?
I'm just saying.
Yeah, one day that might be the news story, right? But it is true, though. I mean, actually, that's funny, Rebecca, but it does bring up a point that we obviously don't talk about the millions of times where that happens, right? We talk about the dramatic episode where somebody refuses conventional medicine beyond all reason with the obvious outcome as a result.
Well, again, look, Steve, you were the one that wanted this down theme. I mean, Rebecca and I will sit here and talk about people getting vaccinated all day. You're the one that was like, you know, bringing the man down.
Christina Applegate had a double mastectomy to save herself from breast cancer, and now she is 100% cancer-free.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm. I read that.
And breast-free.
Yes.
I was very attracted to her when she was on TV.
Who wasn't?
Yeah.
Kelly Bundy?
Yeah, she was gorgeous.
Wow.
Unfortunately, there's no way to warn about the risks of pseudoscience like this without telling cautionary tales that are always tragic and sad. You know, so it puts us in the position of having to do that. But it's we have to do a certain amount of that. You know, this is not benign. And people still come up to us and say, what is the harm? Come on, what's the harm of believing in nonsense and pseudoscience in the context of medicine? It doesn't take much imagination. But for those who don't have the imagination, there's an endless list of these stories.
I'm still not over with the thing with the guy with the foot. I mean, so, okay, it turns gangrenous.
Yeah.
And then he's in the hospital. And he, I mean, is he still refusing treatment all the way?
All the way to the end. The doctor said that if he had accepted treatment even up to 2 hours before he died, he would have had like a 33% chance of surviving.
Oh, God.
Even after it had already gotten to that point.
Wow.
And of course, if he had gotten it, you know, the day earlier, we would have had it almost 100%.
Russ, what the hell were you thinking? A little more honey.
His mother did highlight the fact that his family is suffering for that, because now they not only have to live with the loss, but the knowledge that it was so preventable and senseless.
And if that happened in the United States, that family would be suing the bee honey manufacturers. That's the way it works here.
But not the alternative practitioner. For whatever reason. I see that happening a little bit more, but they're just victims of pseudoscience in medicine, just are, you know, they don't like to sue about it. It's like, which is typical actually of cons in general, that the victims of cons are often, they blame themselves and they're embarrassed something like that. So they don't go after the person who conned them.
Oh, boy.
That's very common.
See, he obviously should have just put butter on that wound.
Enough of that. We're going to move on to a different, a more lighthearted news item. The next news item is about Leonardo da Vinci. An interesting story, although I think that these things capture the public attention for two reasons. Da Vinci's a cool name, and the guy's just a mythic figure, even before the Da Vinci Code and all of that. So any little thing that comes out about Da Vinci, I think, really is grabs the media attention. But tell us about this one, Evan.
Okay, so this story comes to us from the Louvre in Paris, and his famous painting, The Virgin and Child with Saint Anne, was taken down in September for restoration. And while they were restoring it, they pointed out some gray marks that had been previously dismissed as stains. But they realized soon that they were actual sketches, little sketches. One was resembled a horse's head, and one was a human skull. And when you think of sketches or, you know, paintings behind paintings or little, you know, things that are there which aren't supposed to be there, you know, you can't, and when you think of Da Vinci, you can't help think of the Da Vinci Code, that there might be some kind of secret hidden message that Da Vinci was trying to plant in this particular painting, and we just recently discovered it, and this is some kind of, you know, big mystery.
Right.
Well,
right.
Actually, it's not all that big a mystery. So it wasn't unusual for artists to make sketches and sometimes actually paint over existing paintings using the same canvases or planks or whatever it was that they were drawing upon at the time. You know, and Da Vinci was a doodler. He was known to be, you know, to doodle often in his spare time, what little spare time apparently he had. And
that's funny, because I heard he was a diddler.
I think that was lost in translation, Steve.
Jay, that was your line, man. You totally missed that.
I know, you're right. So that painting, probably the price of it couldn't possibly go up, but its value must have gone up because of those that discovery.
Maybe. Oh, yeah. Perhaps. There wasn't any kind of reference as to what it does to the actual price or value.
I'm sure it did. I mean, the interesting thing about this is they think that these may actually be Da Vinci's doodling, you know, his sketches, and that gives insight, you know, in terms of art history into, you know, the process, you know, because usually these are preliminary sketches where he would just draw them on anything. He didn't mean for them to be recorded for posterity. It's just sketching out ideas that he then incorporated or used later on in paintings. But this, again, gives art historians a peek into his process and where he was at that time in his life, because it helps date things as well. You know, helps date exactly when he drew specific things.
Or he could have deliberately planted those there and been like, "This will mess, you know, them up." And
yeah. Just like Jesus in the fossils.
Yeah.
Right. Well, but really, there are people out there who will, you know, who might try to read some kind of secret messages into these sketches or whatever else might be, you know, underneath the painting and so forth, as to some, you know, Da Vinci Code or something along those lines. And it's just, you know, just not the case.
So it's actually an exciting discovery for art history, and it's a cool technology that we can do this, but it has nothing to do with the Da Vinci Code. One more news item. This is actually an update on the long-awaited Medium experiment that we've been working on with Alex Sekiris. So this is, you know, obviously been taking a very long time. We actually did have a couple of people lined up to potentially go through the protocol. But I had a conversation with Alex a couple of weeks ago, and he wants to put that on the back burner because there's something else that he was working on that he wants our help with. And, you know, I agreed to it because the process was taking basically more time than we have. This new protocol he's doing under his open source science is much more preliminary. It's essentially what it is Alex put together a website, and there are four virtual sitters. You know, so a sitter is somebody who gets a reading, and there's like a 15-second recording of them saying, "Hi, this is my name, and this is the person I'm interested in connecting with," and they name a person, and then that's it. So there's really not much information, only whatever you can glean from somebody talking for 15 seconds and saying their name and the name of the person that they're interested in connecting with. And then there are four histories that Alex put together that accurately describe those four people. The four people, not the sitters, but the people they're trying to connect with. And then you go through, you listen to each person's, the 15-second audio, and then you try to match that to the four descriptions of the four people below. So it's pretty straight. It's pretty straightforward as far as that concerned. And then he gives some description on the website about how he tried to, you know, balance it, and so you couldn't infer like how old the person was likely to be by the name, things like that.
Yeah, except for it made no sense. That made no sense at all.
Well, I think what he was trying to say is that
I understand what he's saying. Like there are some young sounding names and some, like, you know, Edith or something.
Yeah,
maybe like
Rose,
an older name,
yeah.
But you can't just balance for that. Like the whole thing baffles and confuses me.
What he's saying is that if you tried to match the people just based upon which names were young sounding and which case names were old sounding and match it to the age, you would still only get about 50% right. I'm not sure exactly
how
he decided what the old and what the young names were. I guess. It's again, this is like a preliminary protocol. This is not the kind of thing that, you know, you would get published.
Yeah, I just want to make absolutely clear that, like, he puts the word science on the page, and this is pretty much nowhere near what science is. This is so not science at all.
What I would consider to be a pilot study.
I wouldn't even know. Come on. It's not even a pilot study would at least imply future science. This is like an internet survey. This is something that could be amusing, you know, as a lark. But this is not science. Like, nothing is going to... I just don't see how anything can come of this. Like, you haven't... There aren't any actual psychics that have been chosen that have claimed to be able to do any sort of thing in particular. There's, you know, a ton of problems with just what he's written down doesn't really make sense. Like, the things you choose for each person are all different, and one even includes a direct quote from the client being read. The clients themselves don't just say, like, their name, the name of the person they're trying to reach, and that's it. They go on and say like other random little tidbits. And I mean, it's so out there. Like, it's what are we trying to accomplish here?
I understand all of that, and that may or may not affect the results, because this is a comparison. It's not based upon how well, an absolute number, how well the matches are made. It's a comparison between skeptics and self-identified skeptics and self-identified psychics. So the question is, who will do better on this matching game? Will self-identified skeptics do better, and will self-identified psychics do better? Actually, my criticism of this is different than what you were talking about, Rebecca. Mine is that what this is really measuring, in my opinion, is who's better at guessing. And in fact, since psychics, if you're a practicing self-identified, you know, so-called or alleged psychic, right? This is what you do, is talk to sitters and cold read them.
That is my point.
Yeah, you're probably okay. Well, if that's your point, I agree. That then you're probably going to be better at this kind of a guessing game than somebody who has never done that, who doesn't do that on a regular basis. But I don't know. We'll see. I wouldn't be surprised if it comes out as no difference either. It depends on if the amount of information that we're getting in those 15-second, you know, hi, my name is so-and-so, if those 15-second audios, if that's really enough to infer anything about the people, or, you know, is it, we'll see. I mean, I think that, then...
That's what I think the problem is. One quote from the site that struck me, he says that as a skeptical participant, you are to use ordinary logic and deduction to answer four questions. Well, how can you use logic and deduction with the sparse information given? You can't. There is no deduction.
If there is a result that shows psychics, for instance, guess better than the skeptics, then all you've shown are that psychics can guess better than skeptics. You've shown absolutely nothing of worth, because you've still got, you know, that direct quote in his descriptions of the people. You've got the random little things they're saying. You've got their accents. You've got, you know, all sorts of things. I mean, you've proven nothing at the end of the day, and you haven't even really prepped us for any future study. To me, it's just utterly worthless.
I'm not sure that what you're saying is incompatible with my characterization of it as a pilot study, because pilot studies don't prove anything either. You can't prove anything with a pilot study. All you're really doing is trying to figure out how to design the next level of study. And as long as there is a direction to this, as long as then you say, okay, so here are the results, you know, what are all the variables, the things we didn't control for, et cetera, that could have influence those results. How could we then take this to the next step and design, you know, a tighter protocol?
I'm not going to put my name on it. Like, it's, I don't think we just don't need to endorse that sort of thing.
Well, we're not signing off on anything. Well, really, what he's asking us, what he asked of me, is that we just let people know that they could, the URL. So any self-identified skeptics who want to go through and try to match up the four things to provide the data points on the skeptic side, then they could do that. So that's what we'll do. We'll have a link to the site if anybody who wants to do this. But we're not endorsing these results in any way, because we were not involved with the design of this test. We did not verify anything. This is Alex did everything totally unilaterally. So we're not being asked to sign off on anything, just to link to it so that he gets skeptics going to it who will do the test and provide the data points on the other side. That's it.
I still want to do the psychic test that we came up with him. I mean, it's just a matter of us just pulling the trigger and setting aside, you know, maybe a weekend to get the work done.
That would be fine. It's, you know, with our schedules, it turned out to be a lot more challenging than we had hoped to line it up. You know, we would still be willing to move forward with that original protocol. I think, you know, Alex is trying to do things online. My big concern is that if he wants to entirely do these protocols online, yeah, it is easier and more convenient, but there are inherent limitations to that. And I don't know if we're going to get to the level of controls that you would need in order to make any kind of firm conclusions with this kind of open-ended online protocol. But whatever, I'd be willing to explore that for a couple of levels if he wants to do that. So we'll have the URL on the notes, the show notes. It's kind of a long URL, so I'm not going to bother reading it, but it will be on the show notes for this episode. Well, let's go on to your questions and emails. The first question comes from Daniel Robbins from New York City, and Daniel writes, We frequently hear from scientists that life on other planets would require the presence of water or carbon or a particular range in temperature. This may be true if they are looking for life and as we find it on Earth. But is this a parochial bias? Are there reasons why life, which would require molecules with the ability to replicate themselves, cannot be fundamentally differently organized from what we find locally and exist in radically different conditions? Daniel, thanks for the question. I think actually that when the topic comes up, in my experience, scientists often question or at least explore the assumption about, you know, what are the limits of how you would define life. Often it's just a matter of throwing in the caveat, you know, what we understand as carbon-based, you know, life.
Life as we know it, they say a lot.
Yeah, life as we know it. Yeah, acknowledging that there could be life based upon a radically different biochemistry that could exist under conditions that would be incompatible with life as we know it on Earth. So I don't think that's a bias. It's pretty much just admitting our limited experience. We only know of one biology, and that's that on Earth. We have not yet found any life outside of Earth.
We're carbonists.
We have this one data point, and carbonist is one way to say it. I've seen carbon chauvinist. I kind of like that one. And we are carbon chauvinists of sorts. You can't help it. You know, it's hard to think outside that carbon box that we've evolved in. So they kind of go for that. But given all that, though, we can still speculate very confidently about extraterrestrial life based on what we know about life on Earth. And it really all boils down to carbon. I mean, carbon is like this wonder element. It's fundamental. It's unlike any other element. It's fundamental to all life on Earth. It's more flexible than any other element at creating covalent bonds where atoms can kind of link up and share electrons. Nothing else can create the vast array of stable and complex molecules like carbon does. And it does this with itself. It does this with other elements like hydrogen and oxygen and nitrogen especially. All of organic chemistry is essentially what? The chemistry of carbon.
Mm-hmm.
It is unique. Then you add to that the fact that it's like the about, I think, the fourth most abundant element in the universe, and that carbon organic compounds have been found in meteorites. They're found in many different areas of space, even in stellar envelopes, they're speculating now. So this stuff is everywhere. So they're really, what I think these scientists or astrobiologists are doing, I mean, they're making this assumption, and it's a valid assumption. They're really, they're playing the odds. If there's going to be life out there, the chance, it seems now that the chances would be is overwhelming that it would be carbon-based. I mean, there's no observations that chemists have made that leads them to think that any other element can produce a variety that carbon can. So they're really just going with the odds.
Mercury-based.
Or silicon-based.
There you go. Yeah, silicon. See, silicon, that's the one. Everyone seems to jump to silicon. And then on the surface, it does. Well, yeah. Well, you got Star Trek. I mean, it's got the Star Trek episode with the Horde, that great episode.
So
right? That's probably where 90% of the people are getting that from. But beyond that, it actually seems on the surface to be a good candidate. It's very abundant. It's near carbon on the periodic table, which means that there's a lot of chemical properties in common. And they both can form long chains or polymers and things. But there's lots of problems with silicon, a couple of them. If you were to breathe silicon, if you oxidized silicon through respiration, you'd produce these solid byproducts, and you know it's not like you would be exhaling carbon dioxide waste like we do. You'd be
shooting pellets,
exhaling bricks of silicon, which would be very difficult. You know, that'd be quite a respiratory challenge.
Although, Bob, if you had, let's say, a complex biochemistry based upon silicon, they probably wouldn't be used oxidizing for energy. They would probably be doing some other kind of reaction for energy, right?
Right, absolutely, because oxygen is definitely the problem there. So that's not a deal breaker, but it's just one of the many problems. You know, it's just so many reasons why carbon is so much better than any other element that maybe 90% or 99% of life out there is based on carbon, but I wouldn't be surprised at all that there's some that are just like, would just blow us away, like, wow, I never would have thought of that in a million years,
mm-hmm.
and I'm sure that's out there. But it's like I said, it's a numbers game.
Yeah, the universe is a big place.
If you're going to look for something that you know will work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there might be some very exotic biochemistries out there. And I do think you're right, Bob. I think that the more, again, we're trying to extrapolate from an N of one, but it's also, as you say, this basic knowledge of chemistry and physics we have to go on. And it certainly seems as if carbon's the most likely candidate for any complex sort of life level biochemistry to evolve, and other, you know, more exotic permutations are not right. necessarily impossible, but are just much, much less likely. But as we say, the universe is a huge place, so less likely does not mean non-existent. But I would point out one other thing as well, and that is that beyond just what life is based on biochemically, there are also some parameters, some limits that we could set on where any kind of life could exist, right? If you get too hot, for example, then no complex molecules of any type could form. So there are some absolute limits to even exotic biochemistry-based life.
Yeah, in the interiors of stars, I'm sure that would be, you know, a major, major problem for life.
Non-trivial problem.
You know, not that, who knows, maybe some super intelligent beings could seed life somehow in stars, but we're talking about life evolving naturally, and it's just not going to happen in certain areas,
right.
like a star. So yeah, you can definitely rule out places.
Well, although, but then, or do you just have to get more exotic? Can you have plasma-based life forms? I mean, you know what I mean? And then that really that begins to stretch the definition of life. But if you keep it at its most basic, something that can, you know, use energy and reproduce itself and grow and move or whatever, then yeah, maybe it might be, it's not being beyond the pale to think of, not even based on molecules interacting chemically with each other, but life based upon some other kind of physical interaction that can occur in these foreboding environments. The next email comes from Cian Hughes from the UK, and he writes, "Hi, this news article talks about commonly held beliefs which the study says are wrong. I wondered if you had seen it and what your thoughts on it were. Regards." Well, yes, we have seen it, and this is a fun winter-themed topic to end up our news and questions segment. Have you guys seen this from the BBC?
Yeah.
Good stuff.
It's interesting. So, and I always like this, you know, the things that everyone knows is true, but in fact that they're wrong.
They're insidious.
Those are always fun. The first myth is hangover cures.
Ugh. And Bloody Marys.
Right.
Nonstop. That's the only way to do
Reflexology.
It.
And what they basically say is that there is no hangover cure. That all of the folk remedies like aspirin, bananas, Vegemite, that must be an Australian one. And even water do not actually cure the hangover. And I looked into this a little bit more deeply. The one that struck me, though, was the water.
That sounds bogus.
That strike me a bit.
Well, Steve,
water should help you.
Like, yeah, I think they're overstating it a little bit.
Well, Steve,
I'm
sorry, can you give us a medical context of what's happening during a hangover?
Well, that's the key. What is a hangover?
It's your brain shrinking.
A hangover is partly caused by dehydration.
So,
I think it's still true that part of the hangover that is caused by dehydration can be prevented or cured by hydration, by drinking a lot of water. So that I think that in this debunking article on the myths, they kind of gloss over that a little bit. But it is true that you can't get rid of all of the symptoms and all of the effects of a hangover just by hydration, because there's a lot of other stuff going on.
Like, it's not going to kick that ugly chick out of your bed.
That's true. That's one thing.
What?
There's a lot of actually biochemical and endocrinological effects of alcohol in the body, and it just takes time to metabolize the downstream, you know, breakdown products of the alcohol. It just takes time.
The only thing they consider then is either it's time or more alcohol.
Well, the alcohol would simply... That's the hair of the dog hypothesis, right?
That would just put off the effect.
Yeah, that just makes you drunk again, so you don't feel the hangover. But then, it just gets worse the second time around. The next one they talk about is if you eat before you go to bed, you'll gain weight because you won't burn off the calories that you just ate. And that's nonsense. It still comes down to calories in, calories out. It doesn't so much matter when you eat the calories or when you burn them off. It's the net in and net out that ultimately matters.
Yeah, there's no getting around that. That's the bottom line.
They cite a study that of 2,500 patients that showed that eating at night was not associated with weight gain. But only if you eat more. You know, it's only if you eat more calories.
But there are some other legitimate concerns with eating late at night, like for people who have heartburn. Right?
Yeah. You should not eat late at night if you have gastric reflux or if you have a hiatal hernia.
I heard it, Heidi.
With the Clavin.
The Clavin.
Oh, Jay. If you were alive 50 years ago, you'd be up on every stage making millions.
if
I yeah, like, you really missed your vaudeville window, Martin. Jay.
Yeah.
They talk about sugar and hyperactivity. We've talked about that one before. Sugar does not make you hyperactive. Here's one. This one I did not know. This they said that poinsettias.
Poinsettia. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Poinsettia.
Are not that toxic. You could actually eat them, and you may get a little sick, but it's not going to kill you.
Yeah, and any of our listeners that want to test that, please email us and let us know how it went.
Yeah.
Oh, you forgot the hat and the cold one.
No,
that's
I'm not
one
forgetting
that
one. Going to that one next.
Oh.
Don't skip shit and then tell me you didn't forget.
Yeah, because she prepared.
I've got my eye on you, all right? And also, you don't lose 40 to 45% of your body heat through your head. That is a common misconception, and it arose presumably because you lose a lot of heat through your head just because most people leave – well, not most people, but if you leave your head uncovered, that's, you know, a significant portion of your body that's exposed to the cold. So you lose pretty much the same amount of heat through the skin on your head as you do through the skin on the rest of your body. It's just that the rest of your body is always covered up when you're outside. So
yeah,
wear a hat.
That's the one.
Yeah, that's right. It's pretty
that's
much
the one that got me.
It's pretty much proportional to your surface area, as you say.
Yeah. And if you have a gigantic head like Steve, then you'll want to wear an extra large hat because you could be losing even more body heat.
I'm totally shocked that that's fake, because
here's the underlying misconception. The misconception that leads to this misconception is that heat rises, and heat does not have any inherent tendency to rise. Heat does not rise. What happens is that warmer air will rise above cooler, relatively cooler air, just like it depends on the substance. The same thing happens for water until it starts to freeze. But heat itself doesn't have any tendency to go away and up, you know, the gravity well. It radiates away from your skin in all directions equally. Convection depends on the motion of stuff that's moving the heat around. And again, there's no heat does not rise. That is just a high school textbook myth. But that's what I think drives this notion that heat's rising up out of your head. And that's why that's false.
And I only lose 4 to 5% of my body heat because I only use 10% of my brain.
That I have to say that thing about the heat leaving your head faster or having, you know, I thought we had more blood flow to our heads or whatever, but that is so freaking deeply grained in my psyche, I'm having a problem not believing it.
You have to unlearn what you have learned.
Little grasshopper.
That one upset me that I bought that. It upset me that I was suckered into that one.
There's one plausible sliver to that, and then like a lot of things, there's often a kernel of truth. The scalp is highly vascularized, so you could say, okay, maybe there's more blood flow to the scalp, and maybe there's more vigorous blood loss.
Your brain uses a significant portion of calories.
Yeah,
so
but that's inside your skull. 20%. I don't know that you lose a lot of heat that way. But and there's also
nice look, I'm just trying to
second
help.
Second law of
Jesus.
Thermodynamics, baby.
But still, it comes down to surface area, and also, our bodies have fairly elaborate mechanisms for contracting blood vessels to limit the blood flow to the skin in order to regulate our body temperature. So if we want to lose more weight, we'll flush the skin with blood to radiate the heat away. If we want to conserve our temperature, our core body temperature, then you know the blood will clamp down and the extremities will become cold. You actually lose, I think percentage-wise, you're going to lose more heat actually from your hands and feet. You're going to radiate more heat away from them than you will any other part of the body.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake. And then I challenge my skeptical colleagues to tell me which one they think is the fake. And you all can play along. Is everyone ready for this week?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
This challenge accepted. The last science or fiction of 2008. Here we go. That's item right. Number 1. In a recent study, researchers find that the children of first cousins have an overall lower risk of genetic disease than the general population. Item number 2. Researchers have developed a new kind of laser from a device 1/10 the thickness of a human hair. And item number 3, scientists have documented a case of a blind man who can flawlessly navigate an obstacle course without relying upon any other senses. Bob, go first.
All right, so the kids of first cousins having an overall lower risk of genetic disease than the general population. Well, I remember reading that first cousins are relatively safe for first cousins to have kids. I don't know where I read that, but lower risk? A lower risk of genetic disease? I don't know. Is it some genetic quirk? I can't imagine. That doesn't sound right to me. I'd say a new kind of laser, 1/10 the thickness of a human hair. I haven't read anything specific to this, but I have come across lots of laser articles that where they're able to create it using solid-state electronics and all this wicked stuff, so that doesn't surprise me at all. Then you got this blind guy that can flawlessly navigate an obstacle course without relying on any other senses.
Other than lasers?
Any other senses. I mean, it just sounds so obviously wrong. I think Steve wants us to pick that.
Don't think of it that way.
I know. I'm also getting the sense that he's messing with the real story.
Pick one.
I'm going to say the kissing cousins is false.
Okay, Jay?
Well, I'm not ready yet.
All right, here we go. In a recent study, researchers find that the children of first cousins have an overall lower risk of genetic disease than the general population. I thought that was 100% opposite. Isn't that where frog people come from? Item number two. Researchers have developed a new kind of laser from a device 1/10 the thickness of a human hair. I totally believe that. Item number three. Scientists have documented a case of a blind man who can flawlessly navigate an obstacle course without relying upon any other senses. If he's not relying on any other senses, then how could he possibly do anything in three dimensions with any kind of accuracy? Right? I'm going to go with number three as a fake.
Okay. Evan?
Yeah, that blind man one, not relying on any other senses? How is that possible? That's fascinating if that's the case. But I think it is a curveball, as I like to say. And the cousins one, with the overall lower risk of genetic disease. I don't think that's right, and I'll say that one is fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
Yeah, the blind one is really interesting, but I think that could be true, because depending upon why he's blind, there are a number of miswirings and things that can go wrong in your brain that might make him unable to process an image somehow, but still be able to see it in a way. And I can buy a very tiny laser beam, 1/10 the thickness of a human hair. That I don't really have anything to judge that on.
Well, it's not a beam. It's not the beam that's thin. It's the
laser. What is it, then?
The laser itself, the device that emits the laser beam.
Oh, a new kind of laser from a device, 1/10. Okay. Oh, so that's kind of crazy. But all right, I can believe it though. The children of first cousins. The last I heard was that they have a lower risk of genetic disease than most people thought, but that risk was still elevated slightly over the general population. So I'm going to say that is fiction.
All righty. So you all agree that researchers have developed a new kind of laser from a device 1/10 the thickness of a human hair. You all agree that that is science, and that one is in fact science.
Yay.
But the gosh.
I'm relieved. What the heck is the application of this thing?
This is cool. This is a this is a new way of generating a laser beam. A new physical property that's being exploited in order to generate a laser beam, a laser from an electronic device. And this is, did you read this one, Bob? This is taking advantage of a process that's called quantum cascade, the quantum cascade effect. This is called a quantum cascade laser. You know, lasers essentially are emitting photons that are all in sync. They're the same color, same wavelength, and they're in sync. So you get a very focused, or it's what's called a coherent beam. That's right. All going in the same direction. It's supposed to be like a scattering of light. And one of the ways in which lasers are emitted is to you excite or heat up or whatever some kind of a material that has a property of ejecting photons from electrons as they drop into a lower energy state.
Yeah, it's called a population inversion. A population inversion is created that brings the electrons to a higher orbit. Then they all release energy when they drop down to their usual orbit, so to speak, and then that releases the coherent laser light.
That's right. This way, though, the cascade effect, the quantum cascade effect, is a way of getting laser light to be emitted from electrons at a higher energy state, not their so-called zero momentum state, by this kind of sort of energy cascading through different states of the electrons until it gets eventually emitted. What this new laser is actually what they found was that in a previous technique they were using to emit a laser through this cascade effect, this quantum cascade effect, they discovered that there was actually a second laser being emitted by the same process.
And
They explored, in other words, they were getting two emissions. They were getting two laser beams being generated at the same time. And this other one is a weaker laser. It's in the mid to far infrared range. But what they found out about it is that it's a lot more efficient. One of the big problems with lasers is that the electrons can reabsorb the photons, and that reduces the efficiency of the laser, how much energy you put in versus how much laser you get out of it. And this second type of laser reduces this reabsorption by 90%. So that could make it for a much more efficient laser. What they're working on now, the next thing they need to do is to figure out how to suppress the primary laser beam that gets emitted from this process, because that is sapping the efficiency of this new laser, if that makes sense. If
they can figure out what one gets stronger, the other one gets weaker, so it's like an inverse relationship almost.
Yeah, exactly. So if they can get rid of the inefficient one and then maximize the efficient laser, then that could lead to lots of applications. This is again because it's mainly infrared range. It's not high enough energy that it's going to be like a military weapon. You know, you're not going to be zapping people on the battlefield with this.
That's too bad.
It's probably not going to be a cutting laser or anything like that either. But this could be used for
communication.
For communications and for detection devices and things like that. They're talking right now that this might be good for things like medical devices and security type of devices. This could be used to detect trace amounts of water vapor, ammonia, nitrogen oxide, other gases. So that one is science.
Cool.
This is all done
at
Princeton University, by the way. In their nano fabrication facility.
Woohoo! Nano.
Princeton. What are they?
Let's go to number study. Researchers find that the children of first cousins have an overall lower risk of genetic disease than the general population, and that one is the fiction.
Yay!
Aha.
And you guys are right. There, in fact, has been a recent editorial published in the PLOS Biology by two zoologists, for some reason, making the point that the science doesn't really back up the laws prohibiting first cousins from marrying. That, yes, there actually is an increase. There's an increase in the risk of genetic diseases from about 1.7 to 2%, which is not as much as a lot of people think, but that there are a lot of other things like giving birth or getting pregnant over the age of 40 or having known genetic diseases that increases the risks even further, and that those things are not outlaws. They say it's hypocritical to outlaw first cousins marrying because of this, you know, 1.7 to 2% increased risk, but not outlaw having kids over the age of 40 or banning people from having kids who have known genetic disorders. So I guess they have a point. The risk is lower than I think a lot of people think, but it is certainly still a little bit higher than the general population. So you guys pretty much hit that one on the head.
And it's still a little weird.
Yeah, that's a different issue. But actually,
the social
issue. I care if we talked about this or not. There was a paper actually published a number of years ago on this whole first cousin marrying thing, and that actually that small increase in the risk of recessive genes where you need two copies of the gene in order to have the disease, that's the problem with first cousins, that there's a higher chance that they have the same recessive gene and that therefore they can line up and you can get a recessive genetic disorder. That's the risk. That small increase in that risk is offset by the fact that you're also maybe reinforcing genes that have positive attributes, and that if you are a successful tribe, for example, that have, you know, beneficial mutations or genes, that, you know, marrying first cousins actually helps to reinforce those advantages, and that in fact it was probably common in our ancestors, and it certainly is common in the animal kingdom, to marry these sort of first, second cousins, these close relatives, with the occasional infusion of genes from much farther afield. So that's why we are actually attracted to people who look like us, but at the same time can be attracted to somebody who looks exotic. That's where the whole concept of exotic comes from. That makes perfect sense in terms of what would be optimal for any population, which means that scientists have documented a case of a blind man who can flawlessly navigate an obstacle course without relying upon any other senses is very interesting science.
Can't wait to hear this one.
Yeah, and Rebecca, you actually, you said what you said didn't make sense, but you were exactly correct.
And yay!
That's awesome.
This guy has cortical blindness, which means that his visual cortex is not processing visual information. And he can't see. He's blind. He cannot see a thing.
I can't see, so good.
Right.
So it's all subconscious, you're saying?
He's not conscious of any vision. He's
blind. So it's all subconsciously then he could navigate.
Yes.
Awesome.
It's all subconscious. What this means is that there are visual pathways that we're not aware of. And that although we suspected were there. And that these visual pathways give information to other parts of the brain that's not involved with conscious visual processing.
Excellent.
So it's subconscious processing.
So to him, it's like magic.
Yeah, it's like magic.
And it's that fits in with, like, the reason why I was thinking of that was that it fits in with studies I've read on people who have brain damage in specific areas, or particularly people who have had their the hemispheres of their brain severed.
Mm-hmm.
And so you show them something with their eye, and, you know, they can, it's like a weird thing where they could describe it, for instance, but they couldn't tell you what it is. Like things like that. Like, oh, it's red and it's round, but they can't pick up on the word apple. Like, just
quite like that. Right. If they're seeing something with the side of their brain that does not speak, that doesn't have language, then they can respond to the stimulus, but they can't talk about it in any way. So, and they may not actually be aware of what they saw. So, for example, like one of the classic tests is to show the person an item and then give them a choice among several items. They'll pick the item that they saw.
They'll pick the one they just saw, but not
even though they're not consciously aware that they saw it. That's right.
Yeah.
Now, just to be specific, though, I think we might need to say that this is the result of having your corpus callosum cut, which connects the hemispheres of your brain, so they're no longer communicating. So this is what creates this dichotomy.
But not necessarily with the blind guy.
That's what creates what Rebecca was talking about, which is a different situation.
Yeah. Right.
The corpus callosum is severed. The two hemispheres cannot communicate as much, and therefore you can get this disconnect between, you know, the conscious or subconscious perception on one side of the brain, but it's not communicating to the part of the brain that can speak, so you can't talk about it.
Yeah.
But in this case is totally different. This guy just has cortical blindness. On both sides of his brain, the parts of his brain that process visual information is damaged. But there is still some visual information going to more automatic or subconscious parts of the brain that it makes sense that we would have hardwiring that would enable us to, say, flinch and get out of the way of something
right.
that comes into our visual field without
like
having
a shoe.
To pick a random example, without having to actually consciously process and be aware of what's happening.
So he can see.
So it's like a primitive part of your brain.
No, he can't see. He's not conscious of any sight.
But he can see.
There are parts of his brain that obviously are getting visual information, but he's still blind.
But he's still picking up information from the world.
Yes, that is
correct. All right, so is that a sense then? Is that something that you would consider him sensing?
So, I know where you're going with this.
Yeah.
A, he is blind. The guy's totally blind.
All right, sure.
And what I wrote was, without using any other senses. Meaning other than sight. But he is getting visual information to subconscious parts of his brain.
This is what we call... The Hucklebuck.
Skullduggery.
No, I disagree, Jay.
Everyone else seemed to get it, Jay. I mean, I worded it very specifically so that it was accurate. Obviously, Jay, you're right that there was a missing piece of information. That was the whole point.
No.
There was that missing piece of information,
but my
description is still accurate.
I'm not reading my quote this week. That's it.
Oh, the world.
Well,
wept.
Thank you, Jay, for standing up for all of our listeners who may feel slighted in the same way. But suck it up.
15,000 of them.
Ugh, I hate you.
Isn't it true, Steve, that the retina does this sort of pre-processing?
There's processing that occurs. I think this is what you're referring to. There's processing that occurs at the brainstem level before it ever gets to the cortex. So yes, a lot of processing actually occurs before the image actually gets to the part of the brain that perceives it.
And we talked about that a while ago, where we were talking about the optical illusions.
Yeah, that enhances three-dimensionality and things like that, yeah. And that's where a lot of optical illusions take place, exactly, because it's this sort of subconscious processing that occurs before it gets to the cortex. But I guess, obviously, some of that information is peeling off and going to other parts of the brain to help us do things like navigate around obstacles, obviously, without having to consciously processing the visual information.
I wonder what else he could do. I wonder what else he could perceive.
I wonder if the researchers are really effing with this guy, like throwing things at him and...
I'll tell you what else he can do, because it was already known that this guy could respond to people's facial expressions. Even though he was...
Really?
Awesome!
It's not conscious. He was subconsciously responding to the emotion, emotionally.
Wow.
Jay, do you have a quote for this week?
I have a quote. This is a quote by Frankie Gizmo. He says... And the blind shall see. Anyway, no, this is I got a quote from Leonardo da Vinci.
Nice,
appropriate.
Check out this guy's list of accolades. Ready? He was an Italian polymath. Right, that's a perfect word for him. A scientist, a mathematician, an engineer, an inventor, an autonomist, a painter, a sculptor, an architect, a botanist, a musician, and a writer.
He was a Renaissance
Ninja Turtle.
And a sketcher.
Yes.
And a doodler, or diddler.
And he had a tremendous singing voice.
But he didn't advance science one bit, because he did not interface with the scientific community.
Oh, shut up.
Wow.
I'm just saying.
He couldn't...
What a waste.
Nothing to the advancement of science.
I contribute nothing.
That's not true.
It is true. His all of everything he did was discovered 100 years later, after they already were figured out. And it was like, oh, look, he knew about this 100 years ago, but he didn't tell anybody, you know.
Yeah. Why did he keep it a secret?
He built a helicopter.
He didn't tell anybody?
He didn't build it.
He sketched it.
He
had an invisibility machine.
Right.
It was amazing.
What an asshole.
It was just
Bob.
It's just an interesting fact about his personality.
You can't call him an asshole. I mean, the guy...
That pisses me off.
I know, but Bob, you know, he was so adept in so many things and everything, and part of his makeup, you know, like that's just who he was.
So basically, so you could like wash away all the scientific achievements, and he's basically just an artist.
I think you're full of lies. I think that he did interface with science. I'm calling BS on that.
Okay, well, we don't really have time to delve into this in detail. Maybe we'll do it in a future episode. But to clarify, he was known during his lifetime as a great artist, of course. He also was known as an engineer. He did have engineering contributions. And he did contribute a lot to the artistic portrayal of anatomy. However, his treatise on anatomy wasn't published for 161 years after his death. But he didn't actually do any scientific experiments, and he didn't actually interface with the scientific community. So I don't think you could say that he really contributed to the advancement of science itself during his lifetime.
I hear he was quotable, too.
Yes. He said, "The truth of things is the chief nutriment of superior intellects." Oh. Leonardo da Vinci! That guy is so freaking cool. I don't even care if he added to science or not. He was one of the coolest people that ever lived.
He was.
That's it.
So suck it, Steve.
I never said otherwise. Well, thank you all for joining me again this week.
Surely.
Thank you, Steve.
This is our last regularly formatted show of 2008. Next week, we will be doing the year-end wrap-up.
Wrap it up.
Last year, I think it was one of my favorite shows.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Rebecca, we told you lately that we love you.
No.
We love you.
I just called to say I love you.
Oh, jeez.
I love you, too.
And until next week... This love fest is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.